Welcome to Caring for Your Aging Parent. My name is Sarah Dimmerman, also known as Help Me Sarah, and today I'm in conversation with Dr. Tiffany Chow. Tiffany is a senior clinician scientist at the Baycrest Rotman Research Institute in Toronto and a behavioral neurologist at the Sam and Ida Ross Memory Clinic. She also holds a dual appointment as Associate Professor of Neurology and Geriatric Psychiatry with the University of Toronto. In January 2013, Tiffany's book, entitled The Memory Clinic, was published by Penguin Books. Welcome, Tiffany.
Thanks for having me, Sarah, and I've been looking forward to talking about these issues with you.
Thank you. So let's jump right in then. I'm sure that throughout our podcast, you'll be able to refer back to your book because I know that it's been really well received. But I'm going to just talk to you about, you know, rather than focusing on the memory issues per se, I'd love to talk to you more about, as well as that, general aging questions. And for those of us who may be in a position where we're beginning to or in the midst of caring for aging parents, this is certainly very topical. So I'm curious to know, in your experience, if there's an age at which adult children typically find that their roles with their parents are beginning to reverse. So they're taking care of their parents more than their parents are taking care of them, for example.
I think that it's an interesting question that I can look at from both directions in terms of what's the age of the adult child, where the adult child starts to pay attention to what's going on with the parent and providing care. And then there's another way of looking at, okay, what age is the parent at which time the child starts to become concerned. So right. The first one is that usually around their 30s, and you can tell me if you've observed the same thing, people start to realize that they're resembling their parents more than they ever thought they would, or maybe even more than they thought they would want to.
Right.
And that identification of self vertically with the parent then allows them to open up to see that parent as another human being, not the authority figure, but another person who has foibles, who suffers, who may need a little bit more help. And this creates a new sort of alliance between adult, child, and parent. And that may be where the care starts. In very small ways, again, as an alliance, like I'm going to help you do some things, but you may not need the help. It's just a way for us to bond a little bit more
right.
and understand each other. And that's a really nice way to start if the culture of that family allows.
Right.
Because then it's a long segue into the parent's much later life.
Right. It's not like a sudden incident that brings that on.
Exactly. And it's the other side of it, the other side of that coin, when you look at it from the aging parent's point of view, what is the age at which something sudden starts to happen? And in my own family, it was very interesting. My parents seemed pretty much the same from their 40s right on through their 60s. But interestingly enough, they both agreed on their 70th birthdays that suddenly things felt different. It was took longer to recover from things, whether it was just a common cold or maybe having hurt the back, lifting something. There was something qualitatively different at 70. And it was so fascinating to me that they said that because I had been talking to my biochemist friends about cell aging and about when does that click over. And it seems to be in the 70th year, we all start to seem to slow down in terms of the body's ability to deal with trauma or challenges or infection.
Right.
That may be about the time where a parent has a fall and breaks a hip. Very sudden, acute, obvious need for help.
Right.
That may be the age where memory fails a bit. That may be the age where one of the spouses dies.
Right.
And for many adult children who have families, you know, young children of their own, the focus has been on those young children, and even the grandparents have been focusing on those young children.
Right.
But in the absence of someone that you've been with as a partner for decades, who's gradually been covering for you, but then suddenly can't do that for you.
Right.
The frailties, the difficulties, the amount of assistance needed suddenly becomes clear to that adult child.
Right.
And that's when all these other things can start to kick in. Wow, how do I spend the time? How do I get help from other people? And those are wonderful discussion points for us.
Well, you know, do you think it's because of the work that you do that your parents were maybe more aware or less in denial, because I'm wondering how many parents would actually come to terms with that at a relatively young age, it would seem, at 70.
I love that you said that that's a relatively young age. For a lot of people in their 30s, 70 seems old.
Right. Well, I guess I'm beyond that. So, but, so 70 doesn't seem that far off anymore.
Well, it's true. And for me, in my clinic, don't tell me you're old until you're in your 80s.
Yeah, or 90s
but
even.
It's true that people feel this sort of slowing down effect. I think during over the lifespan, we notice that there's something a little different about our joints maybe in our 30s.
Right.
And by their 40s, most people have realized there's something that's changed about their metabolism.
Yeah.
So I think that comment from my parents when they were in their 70s wasn't a special insight or prodded by the fact that I'm a doctor. It was really one of those observations of, okay, so on all the big decade birthdays, you expect maybe something's going to change. And all right, so it's the 70s. What are the taxes you pay on your 70s?
Right.
And that was their response.
Yeah.
There are other people who now in our culture, our generation, our cohort is talking about senior moments earlier.
Right.
Talking about baby brain.
Right.
And so I think it will be within our lexicon when we hit our 70s to also be commenting on something like this. I think this is going to become the norm.
Yeah.
That everybody's watching out for this and nervously joking about it.
Well, maybe even books so, like yours kind of highlights it or makes people become more aware of, you know, how to slow it down or things that you can
right.
do and just to be more preventative about it even.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that's happening in today's world is that so many of us are not staying in the same city or town where we grew up.
Right.
So my parents are in Los Angeles. I'm here in Toronto. Unfortunately, they were turning 70 the same year that I left L.A. to move to Toronto. And within that first year, almost as if they were prescient, they both had medical problems that took them to the hospital. So I was flying back and forth quite a bit during that first year. It was hard to settle into Toronto because I spent so much time in Los Angeles.
Right.
And then they got better. And I realized after a little while that I was seeing them less often, and it was almost like I was punishing them for being well.
Yeah.
So I had to resolve, you know, I really need to see my parents with some frequency so that I can see them when they're well.
Right.
And that will give me a good baseline from which I can judge whether there's some other kind of difficulty coming on, whether it's physical or cognitive.
And I know that friends of mine who live, plane rides away from their parents will also say that it is harder when they do see their parents when a year has passed and their parents are getting older, because when you're living in the same city, you don't see the changes as much. But when you have a year apart, you typically will see those changes much more.
Yes. And it helps if you have a sibling who still lives close enough to the parents.
So we're talking a little bit about age-related factors, but what about some other things that may not be age-related? I know when you're writing your book, you know, about how, like, early onset dementia, for example, in your 50s, maybe even before 65, let's say, what are some of the special circumstances like a dementia that might accelerate the role reversal between, you know, parent and child? So maybe, as you said, at 30, typically, you wouldn't be doing as much caregiving, but you might just be looking at your parent as more of an equal human being as opposed to being in that caregiving role.
Exactly.
But there are some things that might accelerate it, like dementia and Alzheimer's. And maybe you could even, I know this is maybe two questions, but you mentioned in your book, and I think this is so true, that a lot of people confuse Alzheimer's and dementia, and a lot of people are not aware. So maybe you could even begin by...
that's a good jump-off point. So dementia is a condition where you have difficulty in at least two cognitive domains. One cognitive domain that most people are aware of would be memory. But other cognitive domains have to do with orienting yourself to space. My most easy to understand and experienced example of that is, where did I leave the car at the shopping mall?
Right.
In the parking lot.
Right.
Another cognitive domain would be your social skills and your personality. There are some dementias, like an early onset dementia called frontotemporal dementia, where the major change noted by family is that the personality has changed. A formerly warm and sociable person becomes very cold and withdrawn. Dementia itself requires not only that there are two or more cognitive domains affected, but that they're impaired enough that you cannot do things on your own anymore. So after a bad night, you or I might have two cognitive domains not firing so well, but we're still able to function on our own, and there's a sense that, you know, I just need to get some more sleep or get over this cold, and I'll be fine again. But in dementia, these progressively worsen as opposed to fluctuating up and down.
Right.
There are many causes of dementia. Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of dementia among the elderly. That means people over the age of 65. And there are different causes besides Alzheimer's disease. There's also dementia with Lewy bodies, which is like a combination of Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's disease itself may, after 7 or more years, lead to cognitive changes that add up to dementia. There's also frontotemporal dementia that I just mentioned a minute ago, which affects a different part of the brain from Alzheimer's disease, and that's why you get the social skill loss as opposed to the memory loss of Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
So these dementias typically don't start before age 50, but of course if they do start around a person's 50s, that person is still working,
right,
trying to work,
right,
and may run into some liability issues or lose the job. And that's when the adult child may become activated. That, wow, what happened to Dad? He loved his job. He was the best guy on their sales force. And now suddenly they're letting him go. Wait a minute. This doesn't sound right.
Yeah.
That could be a big change. Another big change would be something that's not disease related, which would be retirement.
Right.
Whether that's early retirement or retirement after 65, that changes up the dynamic so much for a person.
Right.
And, an adult child will hear about this from that retired person's partner. The classic example is the working man and the woman who was a homemaker raised the kids and has been at home ruling the castle,
right,
running it very well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And the retired man gets in and then he wants to run the castle instead.
Right.
And there's a lot of clash and the adult children have to hear about this when,
right,
they come over for Sunday dinner.
Right.
And so, there's a long transition that needs to happen, and sometimes it's the adult children who need to mediate this. Retirement is something to be celebrated, but it also constitutes a major loss to the person who's retiring. The major loss is that over the course of the week, now we don't have the same structure. We don't have the same people involved, not the same conversations, not the same sense of identity. And that can actually lead to the equivalent of a mourning process, whereby the person feels disoriented, misses that structure, those people. How am I going to replace this?
So I have to ask you a question.
Planning is to figure out, okay, so now I can pursue my hobbies or travel or what is it that I want to do that is going to replace all of these time-consuming and stimulating activities.
So, Tiffany, I have to ask you a question. Are you saying that the retirement may actually, that kind of accelerates the role reversal, or are you saying that it can actually bring on symptoms of dementia?
A little of both. Some people become depressed after they retire. They get into new types of arguments with their partners because the dynamic has shifted, and that depression can lead to decreased concentration, maybe selective hearing, so then that may look on the surface like a memory loss. Gee, I told him 3 times, but he still asked me again as if I'd never said it. That may be because in the new dynamic, we're not communicating as well,
right,
as we did before. And so it's often the adult children who are asked to almost adjudicate, is there something wrong with the person who retired and we just didn't notice it until they retired? Or is this just part of the transition? We all have a sense of community, whether it's a small circle or a much larger global emailing all over the place all the time kind of identity within a community. And when you go away from the workplace, and if you don't have other things that you've worked to develop, other networks that you've worked to develop for social purposes or to pursue your hobbies alongside your career, then it may feel very disorienting and you may not work the same way cognitively as you did before. It shouldn't add up to being completely impaired.
Right.
But if the adult child has their radar set on very sensitive for changes of dementia, they may actually pick up on this parental change and become more worried about it even than the parent is. That's when we need to talk about these things. Go ahead and talk about it at the dinner on Sunday.
Well, really? I mean, do you think that you can raise it at dinner on a Sunday? Don't you? I'm thinking that the person who has maybe early onset would probably be resistant to that or in denial or feel like he's being ganged up against.
Well, absolutely. It depends on the way in which you bring it up. I think nobody likes, even if it's true, nobody likes to be accused of not functioning well.
Right.
So I think it's very natural for an adult child, if they're getting over to Sunday dinner or weekly or monthly or however often it is, to say, so, what you been doing? And the absolute lack of detail or what seem to be the highlights of the week may be the first indicators that there's something different. And I think it's important to see it as something different. Not a warning sign, not a cause for alarm, but, oh, wow, that's, and then we can have a conversation. So if I were to ask you, so what did you do this week? How's retired life?
Yeah.
Pretty open question.
Right.
That allows the parent to say, you know, I'm observing with wonder that I don't know what to do with myself.
Right.
And that's very natural.
Right.
Or if they say things that are very accusatory, or they describe their interactions with people in a completely different way from what you've known as their baseline personality.
Right.
Then that raises a flag, and you don't jump from there into an accusation of, oh, this could be early onset dementia either. You explore that further. You say, gee, I thought you and Joe were really good friends.
Yeah.
And then it's really like having a conversation. I'm wondering what it's like to be retired.
Yeah.
And you are my best source of information today.
Yeah. So, and I guess even as a child, it's probably difficult to even come to terms with that, right? So it would take a lot of pre-thinking and kind of how am I going to approach this? And, you know, listening to a podcast like this just to come up with ideas, because as a child, it probably is scary, too, to see some of these changes.
Absolutely. I remember my dad seemed to me, maybe I hadn't been listening, but it sounded like he was announcing that he was retiring from his dental practice, and he almost was giving me only 2 weeks' notice.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, what's going to happen to all my stuff? Because I'm still a child in my own head.
Right.
And all those things I made for him in first grade and second grade are still on the walls
yeah.
of the office. So when he retires, what's happening to my stuff? That ashtray I made you that's so ugly, but it's so cute, and you kept it all these years. What are you doing with these things?
Right.
And I ran around the office taking pictures of everything, where it was, so that I could comfort myself later that really happened.
Yeah.
And he actually went into retirement gladly. I'm lucky. He went into retirement gladly. And has been filling the time doing things that he wants to do.
And as you said, maybe because he had already been developing those things before he went into retirement.
Yes, that makes it easier.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think it's a good practice for us, regardless of whether we're talking to our parents or our friends or our children, to just ask that open question every once in a while, and there's a quiet moment. So what are you thinking about?
Yeah.
And so, it lets that person share that with you or not share that with you if that's what they would rather do.
Yeah.
But I asked my dad once when he was recovering in a hospital bed, so you've had a couple of days to just sit here and you're not watching TV. What are you thinking about?
Yeah.
And he said, nothing.
And did you take that at
face? That was such a zen answer.
Well, I think some people, it's like kids will say nothing, and you sometimes have to wonder, is it really nothing because it's truly, as you said, like a zen kind of just thinking of nothing? Or is it more that, you know, like is it something else? Like, would you read between the lines?
I think it's really important to try not to read between the lines. Sometimes people say nothing as the response because they've been thinking of so many things without hanging on to any one of those things.
True, yeah.
That it adds up to nothing. And I think that's a really wonderful Buddhist practice. Like, I'm aware that I'm aware.
Yeah.
But I'm not too fixated on one thing. Whereas
right.
the person who's really worried about something holding on to something will be able to answer you very easily.
Right. They'll be perseverating about something.
Exactly. Exactly.
So,
it's really, I think, the common denominator for all the complaints that might alarm a child, an adult child, about a retired parent or an aging parent may actually link back to what's going on with the social integration, the level of social integration with that parent's usual community. Because that's a really good indicator of whether they're well or not.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and it's important to take into consideration, was this parent always a loner?
Yeah.
If so, well, don't take points off. We're looking for changes.
Well, that's the thing. As you just said, you're looking for changes.
Yes.
So for some people, it might be very minor, and for other people, it may be more dramatic.
Yes. And in a sense, it's an opportunity to learn more about your parent, because we can't help but put expectations on other people. Like, if I were retired and I were you, I would be traveling now.
Right.
But that person may hate airports.
Right.
And is put off by security lines and all that stuff.
And always was.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's not cause for alarm. That's just, oh, isn't that interesting? We're so different that way.
Right. So let's say you're around the dinner table and you've acknowledged that there's been some changes. Maybe they're moderate type changes. So where do you go from there? How do you take it one step further in terms of you're aware of it? Maybe your mom is aware that your dad is changing. How do you encourage or how do you facilitate that person to actually get more of a formal type of assessment to determine really if there's something going on?
I would say, first of all, don't take it from just one conversation. If you've been noticing this over the course of a couple of months, then right. It's probably a real signal and not just noise.
Right.
And at that point, if you can, it's best to say to the potential patient, you know, I've been hearing you say over the last couple of months that you're not able to do all those things that were on your bucket list. Do you think we should have a checkup? And really, don't try to use the dementia word. It's so much easier when you phrase it as, I'm a person who cares about you, and I'm a little bit worried about something.
Yeah.
Because that's the common denominator. We're all on the same page here. And then hopefully that parent will be open enough to say, well, what do you think I should do?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, many times that parent is already worried that something bad is happening and they may be resistant, in which case we need to have the family meeting.
Right.
As prescribed by Help Me Sarah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the fact that you're teaching parents of elementary school kids
right.
to have family meetings is such a good baseline practice.
Right.
So that we know we're going to talk about stuff that really matters to us, and it's okay, because we're doing this respectfully.
Yeah.
We're maintaining our integrity and complimenting each other on our honesty,
and I guess
we can all move forward together when we do this regularly.
And I guess it also depends on what's gone on in the past, like, you know, whether that's been part of the way that you do things as a family. It would probably be hard to kind of jump into that when your parents are in their 70s and you're
right.
in their 50s.
Right, so for our listeners today, perhaps the message is, if you are not doing this yet,
right.
you're going to start now while things are easy to talk about.
Right.
Because it will only become harder to talk about them later if you keep sweeping these kinds of conversations under the rug.
So what happens if you get together with your dad or your mom as a family, perhaps, and you talk about it as the way that you said, in a kind of a caring way, and say, I've noticed some changes, and your parent says, what do you mean changes? Like, I'm fine. Like, there's absolutely nothing wrong.
Yes. And I think what I help do as the physician in the room when they finally get to my clinic is to phrase it as, I think we're all going to have different opinions on this, and that's okay. But it might be better for us to be preemptive and make sure that you've had a full checkup.
Right.
Most of the time when people have retired, up until that point, they haven't gone to the doctor that frequently.
Right.
And sometimes the adult child can use the big decade birthday as a way to make sure that that assessment happens. One of the things that I recommend families do is, and even if they think the patient is well, is to make sure there's a thorough geriatric assessment.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is, okay, it might be insulting to the parents to be called geriatric, but at least it's not a dementia workup. Avoid
right.
those words.
Right.
Say instead a full checkup.
Well, it's like
a geriatric assessment. And a geriatric assessment can be done by a family doctor, a geriatrician, a geriatric psychiatrist, or a neurologist. Generally, you would go to the geriatric psychiatrist or the neurologist after the family doctor determines that there may be something worth pursuing. And it's easy to sell if you suggest that both parents, should they be of approximately the same age, do it together.
Right.
So that the parent who's not suspect
Right.
Is doing all the same things. We're trying to get across that we're actually interested in your overall health, and this needs to be done on a regular basis.
Right.
So you retired, now you're 70, let's do the age 70 special. And I have to admit, I tried this trick. I thought my dad was having a big hearing problem, but given the dynamic between my parents, my mom couldn't tell him to go in to get the hearing checked. So I called my dad's doctor, who's a wonderful clinician, and I said, Dad turned 80 this year. Would you please offer him the 80 special to include hearing testing?
Yeah.
And sure enough, it works like a charm. My dad actually called me after the appointment to say, hey, thanks for having suggested this. It was nice to see the doctor again. He was really reassuring about so many things. But would you believe? I think I need hearing aids.
Wow.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Now, I'm lucky. It's not always that easy.
Right.
When you have the resistant parent, again, try to get the partner or even a close friend or a neighbor who's about the same age.
Right.
To reinforce that this is what we do.
Right.
When we are 70, when we are 75, when we are 80.
So my bias, I guess, is I've always used a pediatrician for my children up until a certain age. So I, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel that, you know, pediatricians are specifically trained to work with children. And geriatricians are specifically trained to understand the geriatric population. I mean, how many geriatricians are there out there? I mean, is it easy to find somebody who has?
That's a very good question. Where I come from in the States, some people use their geriatrician as their new family doctor.
Yeah, that's what I would think.
As soon as I hit a certain age, I go from pediatrician to family doctor, and then I go from family doctor to.
Right, that's what I would think.
In this country of Canada, at least in the province of Ontario, the geriatricians are not that numerous, and they need to be seen as specialists.
Right.
So they're not going to manage all of your care. They're going to make recommendations to your family doctor. So they're consultants to your care. At any point, once you're past 60, you can ask for a consultation with a geriatrician. Your family doctor is more likely to automatically refer to a geriatrician if you have several medical problems going on at the same time, for instance, diabetes, hypertension, and a chest pain scare.
Right.
Because the way your body breaks down the drugs, the way you recover from things has now shifted. And therefore, there are some people who have both a family doctor and a geriatrician where the geriatrician sees the patient more than once a year. It really depends on what your other health issues may be. At the same time, I want to go back to your example of the pediatrician. Pediatricians have specific well-child checkpoints.
Right.
In time. And I'm not sure, and we'd have to ask some of our geriatric friends, if there are specific ages at which certain things should happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there are. Unfortunately, the best closest we have is after the age of 50, men should have some kind of scope to make sure that they don't have colon cancer,
right.
Women should have mammograms at a certain age, but we don't quite have something that says everybody at age 70 should have a very brief mental status screen,
right.
Either at the family doctor's office or at the geriatrician's office.
Right.
And maybe that would help, because then the doctor can be the one who suggests these workups to the patient and not the family members. Right now, the onus is on the family to help bring these things to light. As soon as they get the person to the right specialist, then the professional healthcare team can become the bad guys, in quotes.
Right.
They can bring up the issues of, you know, I'm so sorry, but you're having so much trouble with this, that, or the other that you really shouldn't be driving anymore. It's so difficult for families when it's the spouse or the adult child who has to become some sort of enforcer.
Right. And so we talk about caring for a parent, you know, with the topic of this podcast. You know, what I'm hearing is that there's so many ways in which we care. I mean, obviously there's just general caring where we care for each other as human beings. But the caring that we're talking about is kind of the extra caring that is required as a result of some changes, perhaps. And we've talked about, you know, physical changes in terms of mobility or hearing. You know, and then of course we've also talked about, you know, the mental changes, the memory loss, that kind of thing. So, you talked a little bit about, of course, about getting the assessment and how to get the parent to the assessment. But are there places, I know, for example, Baycrest, where you are, I know that you do, that you or your colleagues conduct assessments, correct?
Correct. So what you're looking for, if you are worried about a dementia setting in, is that you're looking for a memory clinic. And we're lucky in Toronto, there are quite a few very good ones. There's Baycrest, Sunnybrook, Center for Addiction and Mental Health, Toronto Western Hospital, the Toronto Memory Clinic. And
what about across Canada? Do you know?
Across Canada, unfortunately, they're fairly sparse. And if you need help to locate one that is in your region, the best place to start may actually be the Alzheimer's Society.
Right.
The local Alzheimer's Society will not only know about which memory clinics are nearby, but they'll also be able to help with resources, whether it's the community care access team that can provide occupational therapy in the patient's home, or Meals on Wheels referrals, or even when we have to get to the point of, gee, they can't live in their own home as they had before, they need to downsize, either in a retirement facility or even in a long-term care facility.
What about the long-term care facilities? I know, I remember my grandmother lived in a long-term, she was in a retirement community, actually, where they had, a floor. I know that typically they have one or two floors that are more dedicated towards residents who have memory loss or who are less capable of caring for themselves. You know, is that, I know that she used all of her life savings to be in what we consider to be, you know, a really nice place. But I know that it's not always affordable for people to go into those long-term care facilities. I hate to use the word facility. I understand facility is an F word in the long-term, in the residential and the retirement community setting.
Yes. Well, it's hard to keep up with the shifting terminology and things.
I know.
Sometimes. I believe the terminology now is retirement community.
Right.
And within retirement communities, there are long-term care environments.
Right.
And, interestingly, there's a conference put on by the Ontario Retirement Communities Association. Their acronym is ORCA, which I like very much. And they asked me to lead a panel in April of 2013.
Right.
Where we're going to discuss the new changes for them, because yes, many of them do have a unit that's maybe euphemistically entitled the memories lane or the memory unit. But it really is for patients who are having more cognitive difficulties. They need much more assistance than the other residents at the retirement community. And these types of rooms and beds are now overflowing. There are not enough long-term care environments for all of the patients who require placement. And the overflow is going to the retirement home, or what has been known as a retirement home. This really changes that community for everyone. Instead of the old days where the minority would have been the cognitively impaired and then the rest of the retirees living there could help accommodate, and this is beautifully shown in that movie Quartet, which I highly recommend.
Oh, yes, I've heard of it.
Anyway, instead of the people who need more help being in the absolute minority, there's going to be enough of them in the retirement community that it impacts life for those who are not cognitively impaired.
Right.
And it may bring them in to also help, which adds meaning to their lives and their days, which will be a wonderful thing, but that's a positive spin. And the reality of it may be that services are harder to get when you're not cognitively impaired living in a retirement facility because all the staff are concentrated on helping the people who need more help.
Right.
So there has been a notable shift, and at the conference where I'm going to help facilitate the speakers panel, we're going to ask some difficult questions about what are you doing to make sure that everybody there feels safe, happy, some affection, some quality to their day.
Now, does ORCA focus on, do they govern or oversee private and public?
I believe so.
Yeah, I mean, because there's a huge, I would imagine, when my grandmother went into a retirement community, you know, we looked at both public and private, and there was a huge disparity between the two.
Yes, and I'll share two things. The first is that my families in my clinic have learned over time that when you first go to tour a facility, you know, the usual shtick is we finally made this difficult decision that the person has to leave their home, and we're going to help tour a few facilities. I know that facility sounds like an F word, but that's what they
yes,
are.
Yes, yes.
to see what it's like. So we can put a rank list together, and the more names of facilities you can put on your rank list, the more likely you are to get into one.
Right.
And
that's the public ones, right?
Family members that they should overlook the exact appearance. Some have very nice facades, but it's not so nice inside. Some just look really old and outdated on the inside. But the most important thing for your loved one is the staff.
Yeah.
Look at how the staff are interacting with the other residents. Are they kind? Are they patient? Are people peripherally arranged in the hallway? Or are they engaged in a common room where
right.
they can either do their own thing or engage with others?
Right.
There's so many qualities of life that don't depend on the color of the paint on the walls.
Right.
Unfortunately, reality is the province cannot keep up with all the renovations needed. Some people opt out of the long-term care facility, the public long-term care facility, because they don't like the way it looks. So they put their loved one, they place their loved one in a retirement community.
Right.
Which does look nice, has fresh carpet, but do the staff there know how to deal with some of the behavioral disturbances that can come when the patient is confused?
How trained are
they? Either
due
to a dementia or delirium from taking too many pain medications after that hip fracture.
Right.
What really counts is the capacity of the staff, the education level of the nurses and personal support workers and others who are helping to make sure that mealtime happens safely and on time every day.
Yeah.
These are the really important things, more so than it's actually kind of cosmetic.
Yeah. So, and beyond that, I mean, you know, we talk about, so knowing about long-term care residences and, you know, retirement communities is so important. And as you said, kind of getting beyond the smoke and mirrors. But, and you've also mentioned the Alzheimer's Association. Are there any other associations or supports or resources that you feel would be really helpful when you're caring for an aging parent?
At Baycrest, in the memory clinic, we're lucky we have a social worker who's also helping the family to make some of these decisions. She'll know the track record of some of the retirement communities that are within our catchment area. And so she can provide some additional assistance. Sometimes the rate limiting step is the length of the wait list, getting into the facility.
Yes.
So there's a matrix of needs. I need this to happen sooner or I need it to happen later. That changes the kinds of choices that you'll have on your menu. And then among those choices, which one will be the best for that particular individual? Do you have a parent who was always a loner and now with Alzheimer's disease or some other type of dementia, they still need to have their own space? If that's the case, they should not go to the long-term care facility.
Yeah.
Because everything's done as a group, very hardwired to institutional schedule.
Right. So maybe having somebody come into the home would be better.
If you can afford that, that may be the best thing. There are also some small, it's almost, I guess I'd like to say it's like the bed and breakfast option
right.
of retirement communities.
Right.
There are some people who open their homes and they have two rooms and they will take only two people who need a place.
Oh.
And it's a very small scale operation, but it's also very individualized care.
So you might know about it at Baycrest, and you've mentioned Baycrest as being one resource. Anything else, not necessarily in Toronto, but just like organizations that you may be able to refer to as well?
I'm trying to think. I imagine probably the best place to go, again, in a general sense across the country, would be your local Alzheimer's Society. They should be aware of all the different agencies. So sometimes you actually have to go to an agency, which will then help place you within the appropriate retirement community.
Right. And
that's probably more time efficient than going to each of the retirement communities and auditioning them.
Yeah. And maybe even speaking, as you said, like you talked about a social worker at Baycrest. I know of a social worker, for example, who she works, I think, I can't remember exactly where she works, but I mean, her specialty is geriatric. And I guess just even talking to a social worker in private practice who has a lot of experience working with the geriatric community would be helpful.
Absolutely. Social workers appear in many contexts, so you might actually contract with one who's working privately, or your family doctor's practice group, or the hospital where your family doctor has a clinic may itself have social workers available to help with this kind of thing. There are social workers at the Alzheimer's Society,
right,
working as counselors. But I guess I can't say enough good things about social workers. They really help us navigate over some of the most difficult bumps in this caring for an elderly parent. And I haven't mentioned stroke yet.
Yeah.
But stroke is one of those things that can alter the physical and the cognitive status of a patient. Sometimes we're so busy worrying about the weakness, the sudden weakness on one side, the bodily weakness, that we don't assess carefully enough for the cognitive changes.
Right.
And I guess there's also a mood shift that will occur when somebody loses ability.
Right.
And that can lead to dysfunction. But that's the very sudden scenario. One night, my dad had a stroke, and now life is really different. They have to move out of their two-story house with stairs.
Yeah. And I guess
Mom
that can
can't
happen.
Lift him. So they both need to go to a retirement community.
Right.
I think the stepped care facility or stepped care retirement community is a really interesting phenomena that works great for some families, where the well parent is in a very sociable retirement wing,
right,
of the same building, not too far away from the person who actually needs nursing care.
Right.
Regularly.
Right. So, you know, there's so much to talk about. I know we could be here for a day. But I wanted to just touch on something that you really talk a lot about in your book, The Memory Clinic, about how caring for an aging parent can become, or how should become, a family affair. And you've touched on that a little bit, but even including your spouse, your own children, so the grandchildren of the elderly parent, what would you like to share about that, the importance of that?
I think the most important take-home point that we can build from given time is that sometimes the person who takes on the primary caregiver role, like an adult child, becomes somewhat isolated in performing that duty. So the busy mother of two and wife, adoring wife, may spend a heck of a lot of time over at grandma and grandpa's house,
right,
helping them out, misses dinner at home with her own family.
Right.
Doesn't have time to get to the gym anymore because that time has now been taken up with taking parents to the doctor's office.
Right.
Going grocery shopping for the parents. And I think it's a big mistake for that adult child to think that he or she needs to do it all by themselves.
Right.
This is the time for the family meeting. This is the time for I'm at home with my kids and my husband, and I will say, wow, okay, I figured out that grandma and grandpa can't fix their own food anymore. So how can we work on this together? Sometimes adult children who are extremely capable will try to, in quotes, spare the rest of the family having to, in quotes, deal with this new problem. However, it's a family. Families come together when any one of them is ill. Grandma has come to babysit the child who has a cold and can't go to school,
right,
but the two parents have to go to work together. This is not much different, except maybe this is a problem that is going to progressively worsen over time as opposed to be gone in 4 days.
Right.
But the adult child really needs to not feel like they are the only person who can help the loved one and can recruit help from own family, can recruit help from that social worker we were talking about before, can recruit help from the doctor's office where their parent is a patient. Because we're all the community of people who are united in caring about and caring for the person who's been affected.
So I guess
whether it's stroke, depression, or dementia.
Yeah. So developing empathy in your, you know, amongst your family members towards people that have helped take care of them too.
It's a wonderful opportunity to discuss empathy and compassion with your children. And one thing that I've been working on with our research is how to explain to children, whether they are elementary school all the way on up to teens, what these changes in the grandparent mean.
Right.
It's not that grandpa's crazy and doesn't love you anymore. It is that he's really having a hard time recognizing people.
Right.
And he may call you by my name because he's gone back in time.
Right.
And you are the age now that he thinks I am.
Right.
And go ahead and talk to him that way. Don't feel like you have to argue with him about who you are. You might actually learn something interesting about me.
Right.
If you just go ahead and let this conversation go on.
Yeah.
This opens up the family meeting to discussions of, so, you know, how do we continue to get to know each other? As opposed to, how can we fix grandpa or grandma with whom something is wrong?
Right, right. Kind of accepting change.
And then the openness of, was there anything that happened on your visit today that's sticking in your mind or that troubled you?
Yeah. And I understand that for some children, I remember when my mom was very sick, that as much as my kids, understood that I wanted to spend more time with her, they were kind of resentful and angry about it.
Yeah.
And I guess just the way that I would do what I would do and what I did is to acknowledge what they're feeling. But as you said, but to try to develop empathy, not to, you know, say, well, how can you be so ungrateful? Do you remember what Nana did for you type of thing? But to acknowledge what they're feeling. And then, as you said, just try to explain the changes.
I think there's three things. Explain the changes so that it's not something to be afraid of. Number two, incorporate them in the caring as much as possible. In fact, some children are actually a lot better at caregiving than adult children are.
Right.
Because children can improvise. Children can change the plan for the day very easily.
Right.
If they thought they were going fishing with grandpa and it turns out we're just taking a walk in the woods instead,
yeah,
it's no big deal to them. Whereas the adult child has more expectations. I readily encourage adult children to get the grandchildren involved in visiting, helping out with the grandparent, because children often can roll with the punches and be more flexible and improvise in a conversation much more readily than the adult child who has grown up with expectations of what this parent can do and will openly show dismay that this is not happening anymore.
Yeah.
And that's a drag for the parent who's affected. I want, as a grandparent, to be just able to enjoy my time with people that I love. I don't want to be criticized. I don't want to feel like I'm disappointing anybody. I want everything that we do together to be okay with everyone.
Right.
And children are really good at doing that.
Right.
The other thing, so that was point two of three. The last thing is that the adult child needs to be somewhat of a team leader by being open about when they messed things up. There's a lot of stress going on for that adult caregiver. Temper will be short. Mistakes will be made. The family meeting, or any time of day, is okay to say to the kids, you know what, I'm so sorry. I blew up at you in the car on the way home. I had too many things on my mind. I am really stressed out about this. It is difficult to see grandma changing so fast. Teach them how one manages stress by admitting to it, apologizing if you could have done something better. And then when it happens again, we can all do it better together.
Mm-hmm.
So important for parents to model what you do in difficult situations for their children.
And just to add to that, because I think that's wonderful advice, but just to add to that too, I think modeling, as you said, is so key. And modeling how you talk about your parents in front of your children, I think really changes the dynamics between the children and their grandparents. So if you say, you know, he's so forgetful, he's always forgetting everything, he's like, I don't know what's the matter with him kind of thing, then they're going to get a kind of a negative spin on it.
Yes.
As opposed to, as you said, more of a caring, you know, I'm concerned about grandpa, he seems to be forgetting things. I know that it's normal with age to forget things, but I really feel like we need to care for him differently.
or he needs a little more help than he used to.
Right, right.
And that is, that shows the symmetry of life. You know, when children are growing up, when we're at our best, we're happy to help them. We know that we're going to have to repeat about 80,000 times how to hold the right way.
Right.
And we don't get angry or exasperated. Or if we do, we apologize and we say, you know what, you just don't know how to do that yet. But you'll learn someday.
Right.
And that's okay. When people have dementia, they're growing down.
Right.
They're losing some of those skills. And you could be equally as frustrated and exasperated and say, why can't you do this anymore? And then the answer is, well, you know what? You can't do this anymore. So let's keep moving.
So it's about acceptance.
Yes, yes.
And I think
the point about acknowledging, I'm sorry, I blew up at you and I didn't mean to, is modeling acceptance of one's own errors, which is so important to model for kids, because some kids, I've noticed, are so hard on themselves when they make a mistake.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, you know, as you said, we try to be more patient. We know that ultimately they'll learn the skill. I think, you know, we can't not think about the fear. And I kind of alluded to this earlier, the fear that adult children have as they see their parents decline, you know, and the whole idea of mortality and losing them one day. So I think when we're impatient with our elderly parents, it's often because we don't want to see what we're seeing. And it's like, just snap out of it. Go back to the way you once were. You know?
Yes, and that has to do with us grasping to the comfortable situation that we had before. It's not unlike at all me saying, what, you're retiring?
Yeah.
It means my second grade project is not going to be on your wall anymore. That means I'm not in the second grade anymore.
Right.
Hey, I don't like that. But it's so true. And I think the way, as you were saying, the way we talk to our children about our own parents, hopefully will model the way they will treat us when we are those elderly parents.
Absolutely.
I'm in a blended family situation, and I am looking forward to whether the way I talk to my stepsons about how people change as they age will open them up to how I'd like to be treated when I need help using a fork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a beautiful way to end. And as I said, I could talk to you all day. You're such a wealth of information. And so not only am I impressed by your knowledge and your compassion, but I just love how you approach your work, which really shines through in your book, your humility, your sharing your personal experience, and your blending together of science and Buddhist principles is so refreshing. And your empathy towards people that you've helped is so wonderful to read about. And I'm sure that the people whose lives you have touched and who you will continue to touch are so grateful to have had that opportunity. So I thank you for touching our lives too. And to those of you who are listening, thanks too. I'm sure you have learned a lot from this podcast. I know I have, caring for your aging parent. To see a full listing of all Help Me Sara podcasts or to learn more about Dr. Tiffany Chow, please visit the podcast section at www.helpmesara.com. You can also subscribe to Help Me Sara podcasts on iTunes, subscribe to my Facebook page, which is Sara Dimmerman, Help Me Sara, or follow me on Twitter at Help Me Sara. Until next time.